Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. Obviously, we'll talk about the shuttle accident or disaster, and we'll also talk a little about what was most interesting and original in President Bush's State of the Union address, and that was a reference to shifting to hydrogen fuel, therefore doing an getting rid of global warming and Middle East, or dependence on Middle East oil. But this is a far-off goal, and we'll be investigating whether, in fact, there are many short-term and interim steps that could be taken to solve these looming problems, and also to get a sense of what hydrogen infrastructure may involve, since it appears that the $1.2 billion that the Bush administration has targeted for hydrogen energy, so far almost all of the money invested has gone into the oil, coal, and natural gas, coal, and nuclear industry. And that seems to be the expectation that is the hydrogen will be the fuel produced by those energy sectors, and we'll look into whether that makes any sense in terms of the net pollution effect. And we'll also talk with Mike Gray, the author of Angle of Attack: Harrison Storms and the Race to the Moon. He also wrote the China Syndrome. So we'll be talking to him at the end of the program about the engineering culture, if you will, the limits of engineering, and how much in many technologies, as nuclear power, and in going to the moon, pushing the envelope, obviously is flirting with disaster. Let me begin, and it's also possible that we'll be getting other calls. This morning all the phones went out again. It happened just a few weeks ago, so it's very difficult to make calls without a telephone. Many of the calls that were made gave the return number that is no longer working, so well, we won't go into that. I'm speaking with Phil Coyle, who is the head of former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was head of test evaluation at the Pentagon. And I wanted to talk to you, Phil Coyle, about the military aspects of the shuttle program and how, obviously, the bottom line is that we have put almost all of our eggs in the shuttle basket, haven't we?
For military purposes, the space shuttle really hasn't worked out. Originally, they thought that they would get a lot of military payloads, but that really hasn't worked out the way the space shuttle program had hoped.
But in terms of a space program, there's not much diversity, right? It's almost all of the focus has been on the shuttles, and now there were five of them, now there are three left. For a while they abandoned the original rocket programs, and now they've revived some of them, small, albeit smaller, but there's nothing else on the boards, is there, in terms of a smaller, less cumbersome, less expensive shuttle vehicle that could be made of more modern components?
That's correct. The main purpose for the shuttle now is to go back and forth to the International Space Station for perfectly peaceful purposes. And you don't need as large a vehicle as the original space shuttles were built to be. You don't need such a large vehicle for that particular mission of just going back and forth to the International Space Station.
So what about the idea? I mean, the Russians or the Soviets had a smaller version of the shuttle that they had in development, but I guess that went out the window when they broke up and became broke. Right?
Yes, but they have their Soyuz vehicle, which is one of which is docked on the space shuttle. On the International Space Station now, and when wealthy American tourists have traveled to the International Space Station, they've used that Soyuz capsule to get up and go back.
And apparently there is a rescue vehicle called Progress. Oh, no, it's not. That's the shuttle vehicle, or at least the one that takes supplies up to the space station.
Yes.
And that's scheduled to go up, I believe, in the interim period, because nobody knows how long the shuttle fleet's going to be grounded. And you've got, what, three people up in the space station, somewhat in limbo.
Yes, I understand there are supplies for them through June. And, of course, they could be resupplied through these Russian supply vehicles. But I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in the spring they don't bring that crew down and replace them with a replacement crew.
And in terms of, you know, there's obviously most of the speculation about what caused the shuttle itself to disintegrate at about 200,000 feet traveling at Mach 8. It apparently, there was some, there's been speculation from the launch where a piece of insulation fell off and struck the leading edge of one of the wings. It's when they take off, apparently, those great big, huge gas bottles that the shuttle's attached to are full of hydrogen, which is sub-zero temperature, so ice forms on it. Chunks of that fall off. What is the... Do you have any... I guess everybody's speculating about it, but it does seem to be a coincidence there, right?
Yes, I think that's what's going to make this investigation so difficult, is there will be so many things they're going to want to look at. They'll certainly want to look at whether or not the foam that came off did damage to that left wing, or whether, as you say, pieces of ice did some damage. They're going to want to look at the auxiliary power unit. Two of those caught fire on Columbia in 1986, and so they'll want to see if that was somehow involved. They'll want to look at the most recent overhaul that was done a couple of years ago out in Palmdale near Los Angeles here, where a new heat protection was put on and a new computerized equipment put in the cockpit. And so there'll be questions, did they somehow change the flight controls in a way that was not meant to be done but happened nevertheless? The Columbia was starting this series of S-turns that it does to lose speed and altitude, and so there'll be questions about whether the flight control system did something wrong at that particular time.
Well, just in terms, again, since you were Assistant Secretary of Defense and head of test evaluation of the Pentagon, NASA went through a budget crisis, and Golden was sort of eased out. He was apparently very much out of the space community and quite dedicated to the goals of exploration, etc. And then they brought in O'Keefe, who was more, I believe, more of a numbers cruncher because there was less money to work with. And apparently the space station itself has chewed up a lot of the money. Now there's a talk that the Department of Defense will step into the breach. What do you expect to happen there? Because there's obviously big pots of money in the Pentagon, particularly earmarked for national missile defense.
Yes, I'm sure that question will come up. NASA really can't afford to do all of the things that it needs to do within its budget. The Department of Defense could help out by paying for some of the things that NASA pays for now. This, of course, will raise concerns about separation of the civilian missions of NASA from the military goals that the Department of Defense has. Some people would like to see a firewall between those two things, and the more the Pentagon would pay for, the lower the firewall. And of course, the Pentagon has its own priorities and might not want to pay for these things anyway.
And in terms of Phil Cole, in terms of speculating about other possibilities that could have caused the space shuttle to disintegrate on reentry, it had what is the belt up there that's full of space debris? Because there's apparently a growing problem of space debris from going back from everything that's been set up there And, you know, if a spanner is dropped, it becomes, or even a fleck of paint. I believe a fleck of paint, did it not impact the windshield of the shuttle when Sally Ride was aboard?
That's correct, and it produced quite a crater in the windshield of the shuttle that she was riding in. And as you say, later they determined that it was caused, this crater, by just something the size of a speck of paint.
NASA, like a thumbnail size.
Yes, exactly. And NASA does replace the windshields of these shuttles from time to time because of damage that's occurred to the windshield.
And where is this belt of debris? Is it above the 200,000 feet mark?
Yes, it's about three times higher. It starts about three times higher than Columbia was when this accident occurred.
Right.
It extends from, say, over 100 miles up to maybe 1,000 miles. Most of the debris is in what they call low Earth orbit, the lower portion of that range. It's a growing problem.
How do they track every little speck of paint? I mean,
well, they can't. There are literally thousands of objects up there, tens of thousands of objects actually, and the smaller they get, the harder they are to track.
Now, wouldn't this interfere with national missile defense potentially?
It's probably, most of the debris is probably too high to be a problem for national missile defense, but the United States conducts its missile defense tests in a way so as to not add to the space debris problem. By that I mean they plan the interceptions when they get them so that both the target and the interceptor are aiming downward at the last second so as to drive any debris down, not up into space.
So, but what's up there that's detectable? I don't know what the size, you know, maybe up to a spanner or size. That's all plotted at in Colorado Springs, isn't it, NORAD?
Yes, they keep track of all of those objects, the ones that they can see, but obviously something the size of a speck of paint they can't see.
Uh-huh. And the Columbia had just gone through this belt. So we can probably eliminate that.
Unless
something happened and took a while to.
Yes, I would have thought if there was any kind of collision of any size that the crew would have known it and would have commented about it, and we would have heard about it in the news.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't think that would be the cause here, but I don't think it's something that you can rule out. And as NASA is saying at this point, you really can't rule out anything yet.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of having had five platforms now in the fleet, and now they're down to three, and they're all going to be grounded until they find out what happened to this one. Obviously, the whole project is the airframe on this one is what, 20 years old? Or?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So if not that there's any money, but if you built something today, you could build a much better and more efficient one, I assume. It's always struck me as being a kind of cobbled together. It's not a very graceful machine. It looks like, just a little huge gas tanks that launch this little thing into not so little. But I mean, aren't there other stuff on the boards, or is there just no money left?
Well, I think the NASA went through this recently, including its new administrator Sean O'Keefe. And they decided against building a new shuttle, perhaps a smaller craft. They didn't really have the money, and so they decided instead to refurbish, to overhaul the existing ones.
And you can do that and be satisfied that you don't have 20-year-old parts in there as well? I mean,
well, as you may have seen in the news, NASA is having to go on eBay to find some of the pieces that they need for the shuttle because they can't get them through commercial sources anymore. And so obviously you can only do this for so long, and eventually I'm sure they're going to have to build some kind of a new vehicle, but that will be a major investment and something which NASA can't afford in its current budget.
and the timeline's not there, right? If there's fatigue is an issue, then the latest one, the Atlantis, is 10 years old, right?
Yes, and so that's the development program could well be a 10 or 20 year program for a new shuttle.
So it's if there's something wrong with the with this system, then there's nothing to replace it.
Not now, and probably NASA. One of the things that will come out of this will be some kind of a plan to replace the shuttle. I think they can't wait forever. They just have to start sometime or other to do this.
Well, after the Challenger disaster, money did flow in.
Yeah.
And prior to it, they were having some budgetary problems. Do you expect the same thing to happen post Columbia disaster?
I wouldn't be surprised. This is not the first problems that Columbia has had, or that the space shuttles have had. They've had problems with leaks and cracks and other kinds of failures. And I think as these things are chronicled again, when all this is put together, it will create a basis for improved budgets for NASA.
But in terms of the current situation, I guess this, you can only speculate on how long they're going to ground this fleet. I mean, I take it they're sort of targeting, trying to zero in on that particular, because the first sensor information came in indicated that there was something wrong on the same side where the piece of debris fell on liftoff, right? And I guess if this is inherent in the way, apparently the takeoff of a shuttle is the most extraordinary experience, and anybody that has done it says it's the most terrifying thing imaginable, sitting on top of enough explosives, I think, to flatten most cities, and the vibrations just sending these great chunks of ice tumbling down. Doesn't that strike you as being kind of a little bit Rube Goldberg? I guess, you know, I don't mean to suggest that there's anything wrong with the technology, but it just it seems to be rather fraught with danger there.
Yes, the rocket engines themselves are quite old. They've been refurbished also, but the rocket engines themselves are quite old, and as is the shuttle vehicle itself. And I'm sure we could do better if we started over again now with the latest technology.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Phil Kaur.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Phil Kaur, who's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense and Head of Test Evaluation at the Pentagon. We're trying to get a sense on how much the military involvement has been in the shuttle program and future military involvement because of the need for funding. I'm now speaking with David Freeman, who is the former head of the Department of Water and Power here in Los Angeles and the Tennessee Valley Authority, and he's now the head of the California Power Authority. And David Freeman, it seems as though, based upon what President Bush surprised most people with in the State of the Union address last Tuesday, where he said that every child born today, by the time they get their first car will be a hydrogen fuel cell car. That caught people by surprise, but the real issue with hydrogen fuel cells or most alternative use of hydrogen, the bottom line is, how do you produce the hydrogen without adding to pollution? If you have a car that doesn't pollute, that's one thing. But in order to get the fuel, if you have to add to the pollution and CO2, then it doesn't make sense.
Well, it's not just a matter of the pollution. We need to get beyond oil if we're going to win the war on terrorism. And right now, the money that we spend on oil is going overseas to fund people like Saddam Hussein and the Saudi Arabian government, which funds the clerics that preach hatred against America. And basically, we are dependent upon Saudi Arabia to provide an oil supply that's priced reasonably so we can get to work. They have the power by just cutting back on oil production to send this country into a recession. And if we're the superpower of the world, we can't go ahead with that. So the president finally got beyond oil, but he's just buying hook, lock, and sinker the automobile industries. Fuel cell car, which, you know, is the car of the future, and it will be for 20 or 30 years. We need hydrogen now, and we need to make it from renewable energy, from solar and wind. Hydrogen can be the way the sun is stored, the solar power is stored, and it basically is a way to put, almost literally, to put the sun in the gas tank and to get us on a truly sustainable, everlasting energy source that will be completely clean. It's not just solar power, it's wind power and other renewable energy sources that have no pollution. What he's talking about is kind of reminds me of the dog races where there's that rabbit out there ahead of the dogs, and the dogs never reach the rabbit. Now, for 25 years, the automobile industry had an electric car out there as the rabbit, and they finally have now recalled the electric cars and say, in a sense, that you can't use them because they won't go far enough. Well, we know, we now have agreement from the president on down that hydrogen is the ideal form of energy, and we need to move swiftly to build huge solar power plants in the desert and tiny solar power plants on the roof of our garage, and take that energy, that electricity that you can produce, and split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you've got the ideal fuel cycle. And you're basically just recycling water, because when you burn the hydrogen, what do you get? You get water again, water vapor. So, you know, we like to, and we should continue to try to do the most difficult things technically, like the space program, and we are all want to see it reinvigorated. But we also use our technical prowess for doing some things right here on Earth, which is getting beyond oil and gradually but surely be in a position that hydrogen, not 20 years from now when some kid becomes an adult, but in the next 2 or 3 years where these adults will be able to avoid more wars.
Well, I think it's pretty clear. It's probably there's a growing awareness amongst the American people that our addiction to oil is fueling those who want to kill us. And we've already fought one war for oil in 91, where the coalition led by the United States fought Saddam Hussein on behalf of Kuwaiti and Saudi, to protect Kuwaiti and Saudi oil. And now, although the administration insists that they're going into Iraq to instill or install democracy, most people in the world think they're after the oil, and apparently that's true in Iraq as much as you can poll the Iraqi people. So there's no question that we are paying increasingly greater price to get our drug in the first place. However, once we burn the drug, it turns into CO2 and then pollutes the atmosphere. So it's you get it coming and going.
Well, Ian, it's not just the CO2. That of course is the prime cause of global warming. But when you burn all that gasoline at the lung level of people in the city streets of America and around the world, you're contaminating their lungs with all sorts of bad stuff. We call it smog, and we don't get too technical, but there are all kinds of local pollutants that will be eliminated. Can you imagine the city of Los Angeles with where all the cars and trucks are just spewing a little bit of water vapor out their exhaust pipe? It's a whole new world. We're talking about fundamentally having clean cities rather than just uttering the words.
Right. Well, it'd be a city that would be spritzed all the time. So it would be a very green city, I imagine.
Yeah, it would be a flowering of an area in the desert, and of course the water that is needed is a tiny bit of our water supply, so that basically hydrogen is the most plentiful thing on Earth and in the heavens. And Jules Verne is the guy that, you know, many, many years ago predicted that sooner or later we'd wise up and get our energy supply from the water. And now it's not like fusion power or Star Wars or something that we don't know whether we can do or not. The technology is there. It's just a matter of having the willpower to decide that we need to get off of this addiction to oil now, not after we're plunged into war after war.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with David Freeman, who is the former head of the Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and now the head of the California Power Authority. And we're talking about how to create the hydrogen that is needed to fuel the cars of the future that President Bush announced $1.2 billion of research money to head towards, although he made it very clear that the car that he was talking about is the hydrogen fuel cell. There are fuel cell cars under development. General Motors has a model that they are showing off called the Hiwire. Of course, the attraction of fuel cells is that there are no moving parts, and that you have hydrogen and oxygen that recombines to create electricity. So it's a reverse electrolysis, I guess, that then drives a hybrid electric drive.
Let's be clear. Neither you nor I are opposed to fuel cells. I mean, I've been a lifelong supporter of the fuel cell. I just know the difficulty, and I know this, that if we develop the infrastructure for hydrogen now with the internal combustion engine, the fuel cell will come sooner, not later. But it is a whole new car, and it contains precious metals, and the durability is unknown. We have invested 100 years in the internal combustion engine. It's a very reliable product, and I say let those folks that want SUVs have their SUVs, but let's run them on hydrogen. And interestingly enough, the Ford Motor Company has unveiled what they call their Model U, which their chairman, Bill Ford, described as comparable to the Model T in its innovation. And the Model U, guess what? It's an SUV that runs entirely on hydrogen with an internal combustion engine, and it has the range and everything else. It's a supermodel modern car. And I guess what we need is to get the American people, and this program is helping do it, to understand what is available and go to the showrooms and order and ask for them. That would maybe wise up the automobile industry to the fact that they've got a product that's got a huge market. Let's call it the Patriot. Let's call this car the Sheet Kicker or something that will bring to the American people the idea that we can get off of this oil habit and do so in this decade, not some futuristic thing. You know, we have a joke about the fuel cell among us so-called experts, that the fuel cell is the power plant of the future, and it always will be.
Well, the Model U believed that the chairman of Ford said would be the 21st century's Model T. It's a hydrogen hybrid because it has a hydrogen engine and an electric drive, of course hydrogen it burns hotter, but it doesn't have as much punch as gasoline. So they
learn how to supercharge.
Yeah, they turbocharge supercharge that engine. It does, of course, because it burns air, has nitrous oxide. It has no CO2 emission
and no other pollutants.
Right, so you'd think that, and also isn't there a kind of potential here if you have a hydrogen engine in the hybrid format. It's not inconceivable that then you could have the surplus electricity used for onboard electrolysis.
Yeah, but you need some solar and wind power to get started to split the water,
right,
and create the hydrogen in the first place. And the interesting thing, I was happened to take a busman's holiday over the end of the year, and I was in the state of Israel, and I visited their solar research facilities, and they have got, you know, it was the Israeli technology that built the plant in the Mojave Desert 15 years ago. They're way beyond that now, and there is a possibility, the very real possibility, of solar power plants in the desert that would provide economical electricity, and it would you have a hydrogen conversion plant right there, so that basically the sun power is converted to hydrogen and piped into where it's needed. But the beautiful thing is you can go the other way, and you can just put a simple solar PV panel on the roof of your garage, and with a very small electrolysis machine and just a garden hose with the water, you can make your own hydrogen at your own home, and never go to a filling station. But every filling station could become a hydrogen station. The thing is that we need to get on with building that infrastructure. Now we need a federal commitment to clean hydrogen and hydrogen now, not to just play a waiting game with the automobile industry that has been resistant to every change for the better that we've had, starting with seat belts on down. We've had to get the public and oftentimes the lawmakers to make them do it. But here's an opportunity for them to get a fuel supply that will run their existing internal combustion engines. We're not asking them to throw away billions and billions of dollars of assembly lines and try something entirely new. Ford and BMW have both built hydrogen cars and with internal combustion engines, and the idea of combining hydrogen with a electric drive, is which Ford did, is a very neat idea. Let's be pushing that. And I'm disappointed that the technical press and the media have not picked up on the significance of the Model U.
Mm-hmm.
This program is the first time I've heard anybody talking about it to the people of America.
Well, I think from what I've got from the press, and of course it's been dominated by in the last 24 hours by the shuttle disaster, but following the president's speech, what I can understand from it is that he plans on going to the fuel cell. He doesn't want to do any interim steps. And let's face it, given the problem of oil dependency and the growing and looming problem of global warming, that you would think that you could encourage interim steps like any hybrid now would be better than the other.
Well, not only that, getting the infrastructure started now is going to bring... If the fuel cell is ever perfected, it's got to have this infrastructure.
To create the hydrogen at any rate.
That's right. And it needs to be clean hydrogen from more and more from renewable energy, so that any initiative worthy of the name ought to include going forward with these advanced solar technologies to develop huge quantities of renewable energy. And then while the sun doesn't shine at night, if it's put in the form of hydrogen, the hydrogen can be used at night. It kind of makes the renewable energy approach a very real thing to supply the bulk of our energy in the future.
So your expectation, Dave Freeman, is that the Bush administration plans to transition the oil industry into hydrogen. And that's what you characterize as unclean hydrogen.
Well, we've got the opportunity here to solve two of the biggest problems on Earth. One, global warming and local pollution. The other, our addiction to oil. And the solution that President Bush is coming up with is, at best, not going to solve only half of it, perhaps too late. We need hydrogen, clean hydrogen, for global warming purposes. And we need hydrogen not made from petroleum for national security purposes. And I sat on a task force with someone as conservative as George Shultz back in the early 70s under the Nixon administration, in which we concluded that if our imports of oil exceeded 10% from outside the Western Hemisphere, that we had a true national security problem. Now, George Shultz is no radical. And this was done by conservative people who really cared about our national security. Now we're importing over half of our oil, And the Energy Department is saying in plain English that it's going to get worse and worse. Now, we've got a problem, not for our grandchildren, but we have a problem right now for every American to at least start reversing the trend and being able to tell the people. Two-thirds of the axis of evil is a major chunk of the world's oil supply, Iraq and Saudi and Iran. And Saudi Arabia, of course, is a mm-hmm. friend of sorts. As long as we turn our back on their funding terrorism and degrading women, and we have to run the risk that the people of Saudi Arabia may overthrow that government any day.
Well, that's the expectation, that this war against Iraq, obviously the United States can defeat Iraq, but the day the war ends is when the problems begin, and there's an expectation that part of the world will perceive this as a U.S.-Israeli victory and therefore never accept it, and we may be in for a long twilight struggle to hold on to this oil.
Well, one thing that every president, including Jimmy Carter on down, have agreed to, that if anybody were to disrupt the Saudi Arabian oil supply, we'd have to go to war. So you're talking about war.
We already have once, and we're about to do it again.
Yeah, and even if we prevail in Iraq, or even if we don't go to war there, if the Saudi Arabian monarchy fails in a radical Muslim government takes over, it's World War III, I'm afraid.
Well, but it just in terms, though, of the politics of oil in the United States as opposed to abroad and in this the new SUV wars that are going on now, by switching to hydrogen, particularly getting direct hydrogen into the cars, because you don't have to change what Detroit produces. Everything that comes off the production line can burn hydrogen. You just have to change the fueling system and the tank and the lines.
Right, it's the same car.
It's the same car. So therefore, this argument about you either are a pig that drives an SUV and doesn't care about the environment, or you have to drive some tiny little car that is vulnerable. That's just nonsense. You can drive any car you want as long as you fuel it with hydrogen.
Right? Now we're offering Detroit an option to where they can keep building the same kind of cars they're building now and get a fuel supply that is going to last throughout the 21st century and beyond. You'd think that they would be eager to jump on that. And of course, if the fuel cell is developed, it will just be a more efficient version of the clean hydrogen car. But we've got to get started on the right foot, and if this is just going to be another way to put a clean cover over dirty oil, it's a step backwards.
Now, just to pin down the last aspect of it, and it's a very exciting idea that you can decentralize energy, that you can have your home electrolysis unit in your garage that overnight could operate off the electric grid that's very cheap, and you're not adding to the pollution index because the electricity is there for the taking. It's being generated anyway. They can't shut down these big nuclear and power plants anyway. So you have that option, but you also have the option of having solar panels on the roof and just water out of the tap. Do these units exist? These home electrolysis units?
Oh yes, I have been up and visited the companies that have been making electrolysis machines for the last 90 years, and they can make them as small as, remember E.T., about that size,
right,
or as large as a football field, and every filling station in the country could become a hydrogen station.
Well, but what about the storage and compression? Because you've got to obviously compress the gas into your tank.
And Ford is actually in their Model U, I think, learned how to build tanks that are safe, that compress the hydrogen up to 10,000 PSI. Compression machinery is not new technology. What we're talking about here is nothing that requires inventions. It's a matter of implementing on a rather large scale technology that is proven, and it's a matter of perfecting the solar technology by putting some real money into demonstrating the ideas to make it cheaper. We know that we can make solar power out of photovoltaic cells, and by the way, that's one of the byproducts of the space program. We wouldn't have PV if we hadn't put the money in the space program and needed power up there where it's closer to the sun, and there's not any lines that'll go that far, so you can't plug in. So we had to develop the photovoltaic cell, and now it's a good product here on Earth. So we can make electricity out of the sun, and we're learning how to do it cheaper and cheaper. And, of course, all of these things would have a wonderful byproduct in the military, because the military is handicapped by their reliance on petroleum and being able to make their own hydrogen and run their tanks and things on hydrogen is an exciting way to improve the prowess of our military.
Well, apparently gasoline costs $400 a gallon at the end of the logistical train in some cases. And apparently their military are ordering hydrogen hybrid vehicles, and they've already got some, and apparently they prefer them because running on an electric motor, you run silently, so they're good for reconnaissance purposes. So,
so the same technology.
So do you think the military can help the civilian? I mean,
well, they have past, and that's a possibility, but if you people are now enjoying hybrid cars by the thousands, all we're talking about is for the gasoline to substitute hydrogen and made from solar, and then you have a drivetrain, a fuel cycle that is completely free of oil and free of pollution. You'd think.
But the message is, this is available now. The hydrogen fuel infrastructure isn't, but there are no technical impediments to burning hydrogen in the car that you have in the garage. So we don't have to wait for 20 years for this perfect thing. There are things that we can do today.
Yeah, and this is not Ian Masters or Dave Freeman saying that. It's the Ford Motor Company.
And BMW, right.
So that's not debatable anymore after the Model U has been unveiled. What's debatable is whether we've got the common sense to go ahead with it, and the problem is that the American people have never been told about this in plain English, and it's a matter of hydrogen illiteracy. I don't mean to blame the people. It just hasn't been explained. And I think this program is one of the first times that people have talked about it in a form that could reach folks. We need a massive program of education, because thus far neither political party has really zeroed in on this option.
Well, President Bush certainly got a jump on them by, and of course his critics say that he was merely throwing a bone to the environmentalists. Because, as we pointed out, this is a long way off. And in the meantime, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. So.
Yes, but he's now recognized that there is something better than oil, and that's progress.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David Freeman.
Sure, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with David Freeman, who's the former head of the Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and now the head of the California Power Authority. We're talking about hydrogen infrastructure, given that hydrogen can be burned in any car that's on the road today. The changing the cars isn't the difficulty. It's getting the hydrogen, and there are non-polluting ways to do it, and it looks as though the direction that the president is taking us in is to hand this over to the oil, natural gas, and nuclear industries, therefore add to the problem rather than reduce it. I'm now speaking with Mike Gray, who is the author of The China Syndrome, a very dramatic story that told the story of an engineer who foresaw a disaster and could have been catastrophic, as it almost was at Three Mile Island in terms of a new meltdown, and as it was at Chernobyl. And also, he wrote a book angle of attack, Harrison Storms and the Race to the Moon, again dealing with the limits of technology and the culture of engineering. So does everybody that worked on the shuttle, did they all, including the people that flew it, did they all understand that they were really pushing the envelope at all times, that this really was a high-risk venture? Is the shock that we're experiencing due to complacency?
It's not due to complacency. I think I'm sure that there will be, when the investigation is complete, they'll find that mistakes were made, as Nixon used to say. But this happens. These guys are pushing the envelope every time they climb in that box. I went to the launch of Apollo 16, and I've been to two shuttle launches, and I can tell you that there is absolutely no doubt in your mind when that thing goes off that these people are leaving town. I mean, it is in the case of the moon rocket, it was 3 miles away, but when the sound wave finally reached us, it just slammed into your chest. You could see it coming across the water. I mean, the enormous power involved in getting off the surface of the planet and into orbit is what we're talking about here, and that energy has to be dissipated on reentry. When you're coming back, you have to burn up all that energy to slow down for a landing. And one of the things they've always been very, very concerned about from the beginning of the design of the space shuttle, and I had the privilege of talking to a lot of the designers because I was researching the book about Harrison Storms while the space shuttle was under construction. And those tiles, those incredibly effective heat shield tiles, are the key to the whole thing. They dissipate this energy and prevent the spaceship from burning up on reentry. And those tiles, they know, can come off under certain circumstances. And apparently what happened here, that this is all preliminary information, it may turn out to be totally incorrect, but what it looks like at first glance is that there was some kind of a sloughing off of insulation from the big fuel tank. That's the big round tank underneath the shuttle that they jettison after they get into orbit. That tank is dropped off, and it burns up on reentry, so there's no way to know what it looked like. But they apparently have some evidence, photographic evidence during the launch, that external tank shed some of its insulation, which impacted on the left wing, probably the leading edge of the left wing of the space shuttle. And one of the first signals that they got in Houston during reentry that what they call an anomaly, something that's out of order, was a sudden increase in tire pressure in the left wheel well.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're
getting ready to lower the landing gear, and that would indicate that something was going wrong in there, and that the left wing was heating up.
Let me just, if I can, I just got a call in here from Raul Sagdayev, who I called earlier, who was the head of the Soviet space program. And let's just bring Raul Sagdayev into the conversation, if I can, Mike Gray.
Sure.
Raul, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell me about the progress. Now there are three men up in space there on the space station, and the shuttle fleet's going to be grounded, and we don't know for how long. The progress is able to go and resupply the space station, is it not?
Yeah, it can. It's bringing usually fuel, food, some of the small hardware instrumentation, but it cannot help to continue to expand the size of the station because the hardware is too heavy for progress.
And tell me about the smaller shuttle that the Soviet Union was developing, because clearly the shuttle that we have there were five of them. We're down to three. The oldest just disintegrated, 20 years on its frame. Clearly, since the R&D process and building of the shuttles, there is much better materials available now. What Tell me about this this platform that
Soviets
right
during 80s were building their own version of shuttle, which was called Buran, which was approximately the same size. But in the process of designing, they started with a small test model, which was unmanned, which was even smaller than the one which could carry even a smaller crew. It was used only for tests of re-entry stage, and then later was abandoned. And finally, the bigger shuttle, the Buran, after one successful flight, also was abandoned because of financial problems.
And, Mike Ray, do you think that that there is... I mean, obviously, there's no money left in NASA, right?
They pretty much stripped it to the bone. I mean, that's one of the problems that they're going to uncover here in this investigation, is that they have drastically reduced the maintenance force at the space shuttle refurbishing complex in Florida. That may or may not have been a factor in this disaster.
And Rausik, Dave, if there are, I mean, what, I guess if there's a better way to go now, but nobody's likely to do it. And it seems to me that if the shuttle fleet's grounded, or if it proves that they don't have the airframe doesn't have the lifespan that we expect, is there any way that any of the work that was done in the Soviet Union could be revived?
I think there are two modes of operation, potentially. If NASA and, in general, if International Station's partners would be ready to give a bigger responsibility to Russians, of course it would cost some money. The modest mode could be to keep current size of the station operational, resupplying with Progress cargo, ships, spacecraft, and delivering the crew up and down with the Soyuz craft. So it would be the modest way of to operate.
So in other words, the United States government could actually, by subcontracting to the Russians,
yes,
could actually fill in the gap and get it done infinitely cheaper.
It would take probably a period of a few years we could keep such a shape of operation. The second, more aggressive mode could be if, in addition to Soyuz and Progress, this small spacecraft, we will contract Russians to build a heavier, to be able to deliver heavier stuff, potentially those pieces of station which are almost finished in fabrication, in production, in the industry, not only in America, but in Japan, in Europe, and send them by heavy Russian booster Proton, just like the first outpost of International Space Station was delivered, the so-called FGV module.
And Mike Ray, do you think that there's a... I mean, obviously there's going to be some more money, and there was after the Challenger disaster, and there'll be probably some more money after this, but this, from what I'm getting from Rausik Dave, you would think that maybe there's a moment here to think about some kind of international consortium to come up with a more advanced less dangerous shuttle system.
Well, there is no question that the technology that exists in the shuttle is, you know, like 20, 30 years old. If you can imagine what a computer, a 20-year-old computer looks like, that gives you some indication of how far off it is. I have a question for your guest. I'm sorry I missed his name.
Rausik Dave.
Does he believe that, let's just say, for example, that the space shuttle or the space shuttle investigation, the accident investigation, drags on and they don't really come to a conclusion, that it's sufficiently murky that they have to essentially ground the shuttle fleet, is it possible for the Russians to rescue the astronauts if something should happen aboard the space station and they need to get them back quickly? Could the Russians step in if the United States was not able to?
Oh, I think Russians have a rather very robust and reliable system to of the rescue based on Soyuz spacecraft. It is based on three crew size ship. They can do it. Yes.
Well, that's a relief. I think the biggest concern that we've got right now, as far as the space program is concerned, Ian, is the war with Iraq. I hate to say it, but I mean, you know, if this war is as destructive as it looked like it's going to be, since the United States not only is going to bear the full cost of this war, unlike the Gulf War I, we're paying off a lot of people in order to get them to go along with us. In Gulf War I, they were paying in. In other words, the Japanese contributed, everybody contributed money, and so it didn't really cost us very much here in the United States to do Gulf War I. This one, we're paying the full gate ourselves, and we're buying off, we're guaranteeing loans to Turkey, we're paying off this country and that country to get them to sign on. So it's going to be a huge financial hit in the face of Bush's enormous tax cuts and a skyrocketing deficit. You know, I'm concerned that we'll be able to pursue the space program. I mean, we should be lining up right now for a mission to Mars. But you can't do that for peanuts. This is not an industry where you can cut costs and not expect to kill people.
Well, I thank you both for joining us, and I thank you particularly, Ralph McDavid, for joining us at the last moment. And I wish we had more time, and Mike, I'll do a follow-up with you as well. And again, Ralph McDavid, I thank you for joining us at the last moment.
Thank you for inviting.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ralph McDavid, who's the former head of the Soviet Union's space program, and Mike Gray, who's the author of The China Syndrome and Angle of Attack, Harrison Storms and the Race to the Moon. Bye.